Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled The Surprising History of the Pledge of Allegiance. We certainly welcome you here this evening and hope that you will visit us often on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and learn about the many fine program events held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Ms. Shelley Lapkoff is a demographer. She earned her PhD in demography and her MA in economics from the University of California at Berkeley. She's taught applied demography in UC Berkeley's demography department and has served as chair of the Applied Demography Committee of the Population Association of America. Today, she is CEO of Lapkoff and Gobelet Demographic Research, providing consulting and expert witness services to a wide variety of clients, including Kaiser Permanente, Girl Scouts of America, U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Stanford University, Monterey Board of Supervisors, San Francisco Unified School District, and many, many others. Please join me in welcoming Shelley Lapkoff as she tells us the surprising stories behind the Venerable Pledge of Allegiance.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. And one of the first questions I get in talking on this topic is, what is a demographer doing talking about the Pledge of Allegiance? And that's after they get over, what is a demographer? But that's the source of another talk. But to answer that question, I want to actually do my own poll here. And I want to ask you how you felt about reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, if in fact you used to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. So here's the pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Now, has everyone pretty much recited this pledge? Yes. Okay, well, in my informal poll, I found that people have reacted to this in three different ways, and see if you're in one of these camps. The first is, many people said it as in elementary school, and they just said it and didn't think about it. Was there anyone like that in here? You just said and didn't give it much thought. And then there's other people who said it and really enjoyed saying it. It was part of a group activity and might have enjoyed that. Yes. Okay. And then there's a third group that you didn't like saying it, either because you, and maybe you didn't say it, or you felt uncomfortable saying it, or you didn't know what you were doing, so you felt a little uncomfortable about that. Okay, well, I'm in that third category, and I felt that way, and I remember from the very first grade feeling this uncomfortable feeling, because I didn't know what the words meant, and was I supposed to say it, and some people were saying it, and some weren't, and I didn't feel right either way. And then, flash forward about 20 years, 30 years, I joined a Toastmasters club. And they started their meetings with the Pledge of Allegiance. And lo and behold, I had those same uncomfortable feelings. And I said, okay, but I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to find out, what is this pledge? What do the words mean? And one thing led to another. I fell in love with the history of the Pledge of Allegiance. So that's from someone who felt uncomfortable saying it from the very beginning. So that's what I'm going to share with you tonight. Okay, and there are three parts to the talk tonight. One is the origins. How did this get written? What do the words mean? Why did the author choose the words that he did? Second, I'll go over how the pledge was changed. Most people know it was changed in 1954 with the Under God Clause. It actually was changed a couple times. So I'll go over that. And then finally, I'll go over the protests to the pledge. It has a rich history of protests, and we have defined a lot of our freedoms in the country because of the Pledge of Allegiance. So to talk about the origins of the pledge, there are three men that I have to tell you about. There's the author, Francis Bellamy. the one with the money, the financier, Daniel Ford, and then the promoter, the one whose brainchild it was a man named James Uppen, who had a passion for the flag. So let's start with the author, Francis Bellamy, because to understand the words that he chose, you need to understand the context in which he lived. He was a Baptist minister and came from a long line of Baptist ministers. And he came from a rather radical family. And in fact, he was so radical in his seminary that they refused to place him with a congregation, even though he was at the top of his class. So it turns out that he was what is called a Christian socialist. And while that may seem surprising to us today, that a socialist would end up writing the Pledge of Allegiance, it wasn't surprising back then. The time was 1892 when he would write the pledge, and it was a time of very different economic situation than we have today. And just to give you a sense of that, may have heard the term the Gilded Age, which is what Mark Twain coined when he wrote his book about the gross materialism of the time. So there was very strong concentrations of wealth, and this was before the labor unions were strong, and things were not good for the working classes. So there was a whole movement called Christian socialism, and you might, has anyone, the name Bellamy sound familiar to people? Yeah, it's probably not because of Francis Bellamy who wrote the pledge, but because of his cousin, Edward Bellamy. And his cousin wrote what was going to be the best-selling novel of the 1890s called Looking Backward. It was a utopian book about the... Actually, it's kind of funny now that we talk about it in 2008. The subtitle is Life in the 2000 AD, in the year 2000. So a man wakes up, and he's suddenly in the year 2000, and we're in a socialist utopian society. So we're not there. However, there were many reforms that came about, and probably many because of the Christian socialism that there was at the times. And many of the reforms happened, the labor reforms, the economic reforms, the environmental reforms, so that there was less of a need to completely overhaul our economic system. But much of that reform was due to the Christian socialism that Francis Bellamy and his cousin believed in. So he was a great orator, Francis Bellamy, and he was a Baptist minister, and something small happened. They moved the church 3 miles away. It was in Boston. And when they did that, it turns out that the congregation changed. He had been speaking to all poor working class people, but when they moved the church, it now bordered on a wealthy area, and it was an economically mixed congregation. Well, after a couple sermons like Jesus was a socialist, the wealthy men of the church basically kicked Francis Bellamy out of the pasture. So one of the wealthy men in that area was a man named Daniel Ford. And he was also a Christian socialist, even though he was so wealthy. And he was the owner and publisher of one of the most beloved magazines of the time, a magazine called The Youth's Companion. And he tapped Francis Bellamy on the shoulder and said, come work for me. I will give you any job you want. You can float around, but come work for me at the magazine. And Francis Bellamy did. And it would be at the magazine that he would write the Pledge of Allegiance. So let me just mention Daniel Ford a bit. He was born in 1822, died in 1899, and he was a very modest man. And it is surprising since his magazine was so popular. So let me tell you something a little quirky about this magazine to show you how popular it was. This is a rendition on the screen of the Youth's Companion. And I want you to look at the upper left-hand corner. I don't know if you all can see that. I've circled it, and I'm going to blow it up. It says Perry Mason and Company. So this was back in the 1890s, well before Earl Stanley Gardner would write his series. So what happened is that normally this is where the publisher would put his name. So it should have said Daniel Ford and Company, but Daniel Ford was such a modest man that he made up a name, and he put it as Perry Mason. Then, much later, Earl Stanley Gardner, who grew up reading The Youth's Companion, loved it so much he wanted to honor the man who owned the magazine. So he went and he thought the owner was Perry Mason, so he named his main character Perry Mason in his stories. But that's just a testament to how beloved this magazine was. Jack London first wrote in the Youth's Companion. Okay, so Francis Bellamy went to work for the Youth's Companion. And now I have to introduce the third person, the promoter of the pledge, a man named James Upham. Now, he was the nephew-in-law of Daniel Ford, and he is what was called head of the premiums department. Now, it turns out when you subscribed to the magazine, you got a gift. So it was an incentive to get a subscription. And that gift was called a premium. So he was in charge of that. But it turns out that not only did you get, not only did they give you a gift, but they also sold things. They sold all sorts of things. They sold watches and shoes and cameras. They even sold microscopes. And guess what else they sold? Flags. Right, they sold flags. He was in charge of selling flags. He was passionate about selling flags. And he started a program. Well, before I tell you about that, I've got on the screen here a schoolhouse. What is missing from this schoolhouse?
Wow.
What do you have? Bells and flags. Okay, so it's... A flag is missing from this schoolhouse. So he started what's called the Schoolhouse Flag Movement in 1888. And he was just a mastermind at coming up with ideas to sell flags. So for one example, he had a contest in the Youth's Companion and said, the student with the best essay about why their school should have a flag, we're going to give away... they're going to win a flag for their school. So this means he's got all the children involved in trying to figure out why their school should have a flag. He's really a brilliant man. But by far, the most successful promotion he had to get flags in schools was with the Pledge of Allegiance. Because in order to have a flag, if you're going to salute the flag, what do you need? You need a flag. Okay. And not only does the school need a flag, but every classroom and every school needs a flag. Okay. So it was really brilliant what he came up with. So let's think, put yourself in his shoes. He actually started the first what's called the first mass marketing program in the country. So it's 1892. And you want to get flags in every schoolhouse in the country. Can you think of some crazy promotion to get flags in every schoolhouse in the country in 1892? Does that mean anything to anybody? What could you do with that, 1892? Well, it turns out that it was the 400th anniversary of Columbus Day. And before James Upham, they basically did not celebrate Columbus Day. I mean, there were a few scattered celebrations here and there, but there wasn't anything that we even called Columbus Day. Well, he decided, is in relation to the World's Fair, Chicago World's Fair, that was also happening at the same time, that was celebrating the 400th anniversary of Columbus Day, or Columbus discovering America, he decided to have a national public school celebration. So the idea is that every school in the country would say the same, would have the same program celebrating Columbus. So there was an address, there were songs, there was a prayer, and there was a flag salute. So if a school wanted to participate in this program, they needed a flag. Okay. Now, he enlisted a lot of support, and it was actually James Upham and Francis Bellamy, the author. So the Chicago World's Fair was behind him, gave him endorsement. The National Education Association, or the state superintendents, gave him endorsements. Of course, the Youth's Companion. He even got Congress and the president to proclaim that it was National Public School Celebration of Columbus Day. So they did an amazing job. And just like today, some things don't change. There was a presidential campaign. And Francis Bellamy went to the contender, who was Grover Cleveland at the time, and got him first to agree that he supported this idea of a national celebration in the schools. And once the contender said yes, then it sort of put pressure on the president to also say, oh, yes, well, I support this too. So they even had a presidential proclamation on it. Okay, so there's kind of a there's a little bit of a story of how the pledge got written. So Francis Bellamy was in charge of the whole day, and he had a lot to do. He wrote this long essay about what people were supposed to say. Not the flag salute, but like many paragraphs long of what all the schools would say, all the teachers would say to the students. He had to plan everything. The last thing he was thinking about was the flag salute. In fact, it was James Upham whose idea it was. So James was supposed to write the flag salute. Well, James is a great marketer. He's not a great wordsmith. So he's going around to all the editors at the Youth's Companion, bugging them, trying to decide what to say. And it's getting down to the deadline, and he still doesn't have a flag salute. So finally, Bellamy finishes with his address, and he's done with his work. And they go out to dinner, and they discuss it. Bellamy goes back to his office. Meanwhile, James Upham is pacing like an expectant father. 2 hours later, Bellamy emerges with the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay, and this is, I have his handwriting up here on the screen, and his pledge is different than we have today. His pledge is, I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. So let me go over why he chose the words that he did, because remember, he has this background of Christian socialism. So first of all, it's also that the Civil War is still present in their mind. It's 1892, and it's the Civil War has been over for 30 years or so, but still, it's still present, and the country has not fully healed from it. And one thing that happened is that when the Confederate soldiers, when they gave up, they had to take an oath of allegiance. So the word allegiance was very common at the time from the Civil War. But Francis didn't want them to take an oath of allegiance or swear allegiance because that interfered with some people's religions. So he wanted to make something a little softer than swearing allegiance. So he used the word pledge. Now, pledge was a very common word at the time. Do you know why it would be common in 1892, the word pledge? So what was happening? People were pledging not to do something in 1892. Drinking. That's right. It was the temperance movement. So they were pledging not to drink. So pledge was a common word at the time, too. So he says, I pledge allegiance to my flag. Now that sounds pretty nice. My flag kind of rolls off your tongue. And his idea, being the socialist that he was that anyone in any country could say this pledge. A Frenchman could say this salute to the French flag. The German could say it to the German flag. And so it was a unifying principle. Okay. And then the one nation indivisible, that refers to the Civil War, of course. You know, and that those three words were very important to Francis Bellamy and that entire generation. Now, this last part, liberty and justice for all, is very interesting. It starts from the French, actually I have a slide on this, the different influences on the pledge. And liberty, equality, and fraternity was the slogan from the French Revolution. So he wanted to say something like that. He decided on liberty and justice. He wanted to say equality. He says this in his notes, in his memoirs, I'd like it to have said with liberty, justice, and equality. But he couldn't use the word equality in 1892. And that's because on the right here, I have symbols for women's liberation movement and also for the civil rights movement among for blacks. People were wanting equality. It was a loaded word. So he said the closest his country could come to equality was for all. So when you say those words, for all, know that we've come a long way. Equality isn't a loaded word anymore in our country. So I also have denoting the Civil War and the temperance movement. Those were the influences on our Pledge of Allegiance. Okay, so I'd now like to shift to the changes in the pledge. There are two major changes to the pledge. The first, as you probably noticed, was I pledge allegiance to my flag. So in 1923, there was a flag conference of patriotic organizations. The president actually opened the conference, but it was not government sanctioned. They were just patriotic organizations that decided to get together. And there were lots of different things going on. Not all states said the same pledge. They used different hand motions for it as well. They just wanted to codify things. So, and they wanted to change the wording. So in 1923, they said, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States. And then in 24, they added of America. So, there was a question as to whether they're using flags. Flags were very common because of James Upham. I mean, I think the reason we have flags in our country, where they're really present in so many places, if you go to other countries, you don't see flags that are as present as they are here. And it's, I think, because of James Upham who did that. So his promotions were very successful. Now, the reason people wanted to change the wording of the pledge was because they were very concerned about immigration. And if you remember your history, it was 1926 that we would restrict immigration. So there were so many people flowing into the country at that time. And they wanted to make sure that the immigrant children knew who they were pledging their allegiance to, which flag they were pledging their allegiance to. Francis Bellamy was alive at the time. He did not like the change because it was sort of more poetic the way he had it to begin with. And so he was a little concerned that it just got too wordy, and he thought it was unnecessary, though he, too, was very concerned about the immigration. And it was the assimilation of young people that was the main reason that he, too, wanted to have the pledge and the flag in the schoolhouses. Okay, so now the other change to the pledge was adding under God in 1954. And many, because it's been in the news, many people are very aware of that. And the main reason people wanted this, by far the main reason, and it's documented, was to distinguish America from the atheistic communists. So there's a lot of concern, how are we different than Russia? And one of the ways that we could be different is by our belief in God. So at first, the Knights of Columbus, which is a Catholic organization, and were very concerned about communism because of their anti-religious stance, they changed the pledge and put under God in the pledge that they spoke in their meetings. And then they lobbied Congress to also make that change. But they were fairly unsuccessful. There were a couple resolutions that were put into Congress, but to no avail. And then what happened is that Eisenhower heard a sermon by George Doherty. And it happened to be on Lincoln Sunday. And Lincoln first used the words, under God, one nation under God, in the Gettysburg Address. So he is slated with the first person to use that term, first president to use that, or to make it well known anyway. So Doherty, in honor of Lincoln Sunday, was saying, we really need to put under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. He convinced Eisenhower. Within a few months, actually on Flag Day of 1954, so that would be in June, Lincoln's birthday is in February, so between February and June, they were able to pass this amendment to the Pledge of Allegiance. And that's how we have that change. And Doherty, in his sermon, specifically talked about the communists in Russia, and that's why we needed to make that change. So it turns out Under God in the Pledge is very popular. In 1953, the Gallup poll surveyed Americans. 69% said they favored adding Under God. 21% were opposed, and 10% had no opinion. In 2002, after the court case where the Ninth Circuit Court said it would be unconstitutional to continue to say the pledge in schools with the Under God clause, they asked Americans again, the Gallup poll asked again, do you think it Under God is constitutional? 84% said yes. In other words, keep Under God in the pledge. So now I'd like to turn to the protests to the pledge, because there's been a rich history of that. And there have basically been two grounds on which people protest saying the pledge. One is religious. There are some people who said it's against their religion to pledge allegiance to the flag. And the second reason is for political purposes, political grounds. They want to make a political statement. They want to protest something that the government is doing, and they do it by not saying the pledge. So I'm going to go over those two. So before 1935, there are many small groups, probably the most well-known is the Mennonites, who refused to say the pledge. And basically, most of these were saying that if they said the pledge, then it was going to lead to militarism, and they were pacifists. So there's a group, and there's one I just want to note, because we're in San Francisco, a resident of Solano County who got in the news and said patriotism leads to militarism. So there were these protests against saying the pledge. But by far, the most important group that protested the pledge was the Jehovah Witnesses. And I would say there's a dark period in the pledge history between 1940 and 1943. So I just want to spend a few minutes telling you what happened. So the Jehovah Witnesses would not pledge allegiance, and their leader, a man named Rutherford, specifically told them, do not say the pledge. You shouldn't be giving your allegiance to anyone but Jehovah. So the young children were not saying their pledge of allegiance. They were getting expelled from the schools. Not only were they expelled from the schools, but then the parents were fined because their kids were not in school. And in some cases, they were even put in jail because their children were not in school. So then the Jehovah Witnesses had to start private schools and this and that. But it got difficult. Well, the Jehovah Witnesses kept bringing court cases up to say they against this. And in 1940, they were very successful. They got all the way up to the Supreme Court. Everybody was favorable. They were saying, no, they do not have to say the Pledge of Allegiance, and it's a matter of their religious freedom. In 1940, it was on the eve of World War II, the Supreme Court said they had to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And it was surprising because it was a liberal court, supposedly liberal court. So when that happened, the spring and summer of 1940, there were hate crimes against the Jehovah Witnesses. And I'm going to have a statistic here. 1,500 witnesses endured a total of 335 separate mobbings in 44 states. This man on the cover of the book, Judging Jehovah's Witnesses, was put in jail in Arizona. So what happened was that the townspeople, once that Supreme Court decision came out, the townspeople felt that they could take the law into their own hands, so to speak. So just like today, the Jehovah's Witnesses are going door to door, and the townspeople in some places came out and said, here's a flag, say the pledge. And they wouldn't, and then they would beat them up. Sometimes they would destroy their cars, and they had to walk out of town. There's a lot of stories about what happened. In fact, a whole book written on what happened during this time. And another thing is Eleanor Roosevelt had a column in the paper, and she even deplored this and called for her countrymen to stop the violence against the Jehovah's Witnesses. Okay, in 1943, the Supreme Court overturned itself in a case, West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett. And it was a very dramatic ruling. First of all, it was also displayed on Flag Day. The Supreme Court likes to make its rulings on Flag Day about the Pledge of Allegiance. But more important than that, Jackson, who's writing for the majority, said, it is not a matter of religious freedom, whether people should say the pledge or not. It's a matter of freedom of speech. So this laid out a whole new groundwork for our civil liberties and for freedom of speech. So until the current situation with the under God, which I'll go over in a minute, that's pretty much ended the religious issues with saying the pledge. Oh, actually, I also have a scene here. This is a Kingdom Hall that was sacked from the Jehovah's Witnesses. Okay, but I want to turn now to the political dissent. And most of the political dissent with the pledge happened in the 1960s. And people basically wanted to make a statement that they were unhappy with the government policies. Over and over again, the students cited the term with liberty and justice for all. They were saying, we don't have liberty and justice for all. And they often cited the civil rights movement of the blacks as saying, we do not have liberty and justice for all people. And this was especially in the early 60s. So the response to that was saying, well, we want to have liberty and justice for all. It's an aspiration. It's an affirmation of what we want. It's not saying that it is, in fact, the situation. This is what the principals would say to the students. But nonetheless, the students would feel that it was a lie, some of them, to say the pledge because of this clause. A second issue is standing for the pledge. So in 1943, it was clear you didn't have to say the pledge. But if you didn't want to say it, students were sometimes told to leave the room or that they had to stay standing. So sometimes the students wanted to sit and they wanted to be in the room. And there were several court cases in several states. And basically, it came out that standing is an expression. So saying the pledge is freedom of speech. Standing or sitting is an expression of that as well. So the Supreme Court eventually said, yes, people do not have to stand. You know, it's all one thing. Whether you stand and sit, that is a way of protesting or making a statement as well. Last issue was the application to teachers. So the students had these rights of freedom of speech, but it took a while for the teachers to also get those rights as well. And that actually was the case with Dukakis. Do you remember in the Dukakis presidential race, there was an issue with the pledge, and the older Bush, made an issue out of it that Dukakis vetoed a bill that came in Massachusetts to compel all teachers to say the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, Dukakis vetoed it because it was unconstitutional. So, and it was well established by then. And it's sort of ironic, the more the courts ruled towards more and more freedom, First Amendment rights, the more the state legislatures tried to pass laws to require compliance. So it was an active area of law for a while. So the latest challenge, many of you have heard of, is from Mike Newdow. He's a proclaimed atheist, and he has argued that he does not want his child being in school hearing the Pledge of Allegiance because it sounds like a prayer, and that is opposite his religious stance. So the key here, I think, I actually heard Mike Newdow talk at a mock court in UC Berkeley in Bold Hall, and he's actually a very passionate and brilliant orator. And I think it comes down to whether you think atheism is a religious position. And if it is, then, and it's covered under our rights of religion, then I think that's his strongest case. But it requires you to believe that atheism is a religious stance. So the Ninth Circuit Court agreed with Newdow. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that he lacked standing because he didn't have custody of his daughter. So basically, they punted. Three justices, a minority, said, even if he had standing, we would have thrown this out and said it didn't matter, under God, is still constitutional. But five justices did not agree, and five justices just said he doesn't have standing and we're not ruling on it. And then the last judge, Rehnquist, had to excuse himself for his comments before the case came to the Supreme Court. Okay, but it continues. Newdow has found two other families that he is now representing. These are people who are intact, they're married, and they have children in the school, and all parents agree and the child agree that they don't want to hear the Pledge of Allegiance with the term under God. Now, just parenthetically, Newdow was divorced, and the mother of the child and the child said they had no problem with the pledge. It was just Newdow. So all of those problems are absent now because he's got two families that are all in alignment and all say that they do not want to be in school hearing the Pledge of Allegiance with the term under God. So where it is right now is the district court judge ruled in favor of Newdow. And then he went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He had oral arguments in December 2007, and he's waiting to hear word. I would guess, well, maybe I shouldn't guess. Anyway, the last time this came up, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals voted with Newdow. So I think people, in either case, no matter what, it's getting appealed to the Supreme Court. So I think in the next year or two, we're going to see a very important Supreme Court case regarding the Under God Clause in the Pledge of Allegiance. So in conclusion, I just want to make a few comments. It's amazing to me Under God, as well as Liberty and Justice for All, have really created a lot of passion for people who want to say it and people who don't want to say it. And I, for one, understand, going back to my childhood why I had trouble with that liberty and justice for all, because there was probably a sense of, well, is this true or not, and am I... And now I understand it. It can be thought of as an affirmation, and it can also be thought of as a political statement to make a comment that you don't agree that there is liberty and justice for all. I think that the strong feelings of about the pledge are sometimes at odds with our constitutional rights. And I find this somewhat paradoxical. It is the right of dissent in America is probably one of our strongest and most unique characteristics about our government. And it's probably our biggest historical achievement in the struggle for human rights. And yet, to apply that to the pledge and to the flag, the very symbols of America, is very difficult for some people to accept, to express consent, dissent in that way. So I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, well, Shelley, thank you so much for sharing some very interesting insights and, as you say, amazing stories about this this particular pledge. I guess I'll lead off with a question, and then I look for the raised hands, and I'll get the microphone to you. I guess, of the many, many questions that arise, Bellamy, you had mentioned, had the words pledge to my flag, and implying that, well, the Germans this and the French that. And it does lead the question in my mind to, what are you aware that other peoples, other nations do relative to their flags? If you could comment on that.
To the best of my knowledge, I think only the Philippines actually has a pledge, and they have that because of us. But other nations typically sing their national anthem, often with their hand over their heart, and they don't have pledges to the flag. So it is uniquely James Upham that got us into that flag.
It was this guy who was trying to sell flags.
And
as long as I do, and that was short and sweet, if I may, then could you comment on, and perhaps I missed it, I don't think I did, but the whole issue of the hand over the heart, origins of that or where that began?
Yes. So actually that is very interesting. So when, and I didn't cover that, so thanks for asking for that. When they were in the office, so this is when Bellamy writes the pledge, and he and James Upham comes to his office and he's reading the pledge. Upham, when it says, "I pledge allegiance to my flag," Upham raises his hand with his hand outstretched, palm up. And that was how the pledge was said, and you kept your hand up like this throughout the rest of the pledge. Okay? And there's many historical documents where it looks like this. Well, the problem, as many some of you may know, is in 1942, when it went to Congress to codify, this looked too much like the Heil Hitler slogan. So they said, we've got to do something about it. And they even talked about it a little bit among the patriotic organizations. They said, oh, don't worry about it. We shouldn't have the fad, you know, be so affected by the fad of Nazism. But they did. And so then they had it where you just put your hand on your heart. There was also kind of a funny story in the flag convention, because at first, the flag convention, it was again 23-24, and both women and men were at the convention, and this is right in the height of the women's movement. They had a different flag salute for the women as the men. And the women kind of had, they didn't like that. So there was this debate. And so the issue is the men were supposed to take off their hat and put their hat over their right shoulder. So, but they didn't want the women to have to take off their hats, right? Because that's part of their hairdo in some cases. So the women said, okay, well, we're going to give the military salute. But they didn't want that because they wanted the military salute to be reserved for veterans or current active military. So then somebody brought up, well, you know, this, the regular salute and taking your hat and doing that is really the same salute. So then the women said, okay. And that was the end of the debate. But it just showed how impassioned the gender situation was at that time.
So I want to remind our audience that we're listening to Shelley Lapkoff tell us about the surprising stories and history behind our Pledge of Allegiance. Other questions?
I noticed that I was intrigued by Bellamy's handwriting, and I noticed that he crosses his T's the same way that Amelia Earhart and Mother Teresa and Mahatma Gandhi cross theirs, and they're all visionaries, and I wonder if you thought that he was a visionary also.
Right. So the question is whether I thought that Bellamy was also a visionary. I actually do think so, but very much so in his former, before he went to work for the Youth Companion. Certainly his visionary oration came out in the pledge. He later went on to become an advertising man for Madison Fifth Avenue. So he has kind of an interesting story. He does. And he thought very, yes. And I think that one of the reasons the pledge has lasted so long was because of his wordsmith, you know, his love of history and love of humanity. Yes, he was definitely an independent thinker. Oh, from the handwriting you're saying, yes.
How does the plaintiff's objection to the use of under God, or how can that be reconciled with the fact that we have in God we trust on our coins stemming back, I don't know, maybe 150 years?
Well, that's a good question. And Newdow also has a lawsuit against the coins, the term in God we trust. But I actually, there's also a second answer to this, which I think is important. And that is, and both cases came to the district court. And the district court judge ruled in favor of Newdow for the pledge, but against Newdow regarding the coins. And the reason is because they're saying now that the in God we trust and under God is ceremonial, and it's not so, it doesn't invoke religion. But for elementary school students to hear the term under God, that is for them a prayer. I mean, that God may be one of the few, and Newdow said this when he was arguing in mock trial, God may be one of the few words that they recognize in the Pledge of Allegiance that they're saying, you know. So to a 5 to 10-year-old, they may see the pledge as a prayer. And for that reason, and that reason alone, he went with Newdow because of the susceptibility and vulnerability of young children, but ruled against him regarding the coins.
Okay. Shelley, when is Flag Day? How do most people celebrate it, and are there greeting cards for it yet?
Flag Day is June 14th, and it was the day that the Continental Congress accepted the flag way back with Betsy Ross or whoever it was back then. So it was very, very old, and they resurrected it that it was June 14th that they accepted the flag and voted for it. And I don't know how it's, I don't think anybody, well, there have been sporadic patriotic plans during that day. So, but I, to my knowledge, no organized holiday.
I have a question. Isn't under God we trust and under God a Christian saying and for Christian religion? Because isn't when Buddhism or Hinduism or other religions, do they call their God God? Because the Muslims call him Allah. So if we use God, it's a definitely Christian saying, and in our constitution we say it's a freedom of religion. So for that point, I would think it should be removed if we have freedom of religion.
Okay, I didn't see a question in that, but
would you care to comment on it? Or,
So, your point is well taken. Yeah.
Thank you. I have sort of a similar question. As a convert to Judaism, I don't know what your religious background is, or can anyone perhaps answer the question, what really is there to say about, you know, maybe about Judaism relating to democracy, and also how the, you know, how can the two really differ from a religion? I mean, as far as democracy goes, I mean, isn't it sort of a religious sort of act, you know, to be patriotic, you know, in the sense of American, the freedom, the justice, you know, and, you know, to sort of swear by it. And I liked what she said also about using the word God. Thanks.
I'm not quite sure what the question was. Shelley, I'm just going to say,
first of all, you're free to comment on this. Of course, and we are getting a little bit off the Pledge of Allegiance per se, but so I don't want to put you on the spot, but please feel free to comment if you'd like.
I'm not quite sure your comments, but if you're saying that people feel strongly about our social, about our rights, our human rights?
I ask myself, you know, I struggle with this question myself. You know, is it a religion?
Sorry.
Is what a religion?
You've got
the
me
democracy?
Thinking now. Sure. You've got me thinking now, actually, you know. Because
good.
I think, you know, I'm a convert to Judaism, and I find that democracy is very much, I believe, from my understanding, is a part of that religion. So,
interesting.
It's very similar, yes.
Yeah, thank you for your comment.
It's interesting, the religious protests have been from the Mennonites and the Jehovah's Witnesses, but our country is founded on Judeo-Christian ethics. Our laws come from the Bible. And under God and all that is in our founding documents. Our forefathers all said it and everything. But I was interested to see that no Orthodox Jew had a protest because, of course, Orthodox Jews cannot say or write the word God. I wondered if any Jews had ever had that similar religious protest.
That is interesting. And as someone Jewish, I did notice how I was writing God all the way through this PowerPoint. And I was thinking, oh, does it matter that it's electronic? Because we're supposed to put a dash between the G and the D. But I'm not Orthodox, and I don't know. So, but I haven't heard anyone.
Shelley, I'd like to bring you back to a little bit of demography and statistics, if you wouldn't mind. So you had a bar chart up there. You were talking about how, what was it, at one time, several years ago, the under God was somewhere down there, and then it was a little higher in more recent times. But even beyond that, I'm wondering about, so we got our red states and our blue states and kind of this almost 50-50 thing that often seems to be. What sort of either data, statistics, or your sense of things, what sort of percent of Americans, if there is such a sense, care about this or have problems with it in the way that you're, I mean, are we, is this a big thing, 60-40, 70-30? I mean, what's some more data? Please give us some demographers more data a little bit about where this thing stands.
Well, I started gathering data at the beginning of this talk, and I think that's the only data I've really seen on the fact. But I'd say about half of the group raised their hands to saying they just said and it wasn't any big deal to them. And then there was a smattering of people who really liked to say it, and then a larger smattering of people who felt uncomfortable saying the Pledge of Allegiance. So it's surprising to me how strongly people feel about this topic. I'd say probably half the people maybe don't care so much one way or the other, but then of the people who care, they have really strong feelings about it.
And you have, in the various talks you've given to other groups and so forth, seen where groups of people, in other words, there's a measurable sense of discomfort. Is that what I'm hearing, that those groups have some discomfort?
I think there's people who have discomfort saying the pledge, because, and you know, Francis Bellamy even said,
these children aren't going to know what they're saying, and that's okay. We want to get those words ingrained in their head so that when they're older, they'll know what they're saying. But he knew that as a young child, they're not going to really know what they're saying. So a lot of people have problems with the government doing exactly that, having this recitation of people not knowing what they're really saying. And then, of course, there are people who think this is a very patriotic situation, and they want to make sure that this enshrined oath continues.
Dr. Lefkoff, every elected public official in the United States of America, from the president on down, takes an oath of office in which he promises to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America, and also all federal government employees. We had to take the same or similar oath to uphold the Constitution. Now, in the event, which I hope doesn't happen, that the Supreme Court rules in favor of Crackpot Newdow, I'm wondering, would it be feasible possibly to amend this to say that we pledge allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and as the flag that represents that, rather than to just simply say we pledge allegiance to the flag? Couldn't we put the word Constitution in there somewhere? Because that's really what we, when we work for the government, we promise to do that.
Very interesting. Thank you. I hadn't heard that suggestion before. There are other suggestions to amend the pledge, including to put the word equality back in, like Bellamy wanted. There was a movement at one point to do that. But this is the first I've heard of putting Constitution. It's an interesting idea. Well, thank you.
I find it very interesting how important words are, and it's very spiritual to talk with the correct words and for communication. And I never really thought about the words before, and I would assume that under God is whatever we think it is, and if there's an Islamic person, they'll put their hand in the Quran. But a reason to keep the pledge as it is might be historical. And what do people say about the historical significance of keeping it or changing it for the time in which we interpret things?
Right. And I think people don't like change. And so when in 2002 people didn't want the pledge changed, it was actually a higher percentage than in 53 before it got changed. So I think you make a good point. People don't like change sometimes.
I was in the elementary grades in the early 1940s, and I remember every year we came to school and we had to do a different thing with our hands. It was started with this, and then it came to that, and then it came to this, and it was very complicated. But fortunately...
And then you had to stop saying under God at some point, too.
Well, no, we didn't say under God.
Right.
And, in fact, that was an issue that didn't come up until I was in college, when college students don't say the Pledge of Allegiance very much. But the problem, I think, is that under God becomes an offensive issue for all kinds of reasons. Some people, everybody believes in different gods. Some people don't believe in any God at all. And that's not a unifying thing, but a dividing thing. And I think this is a big problem. I would comment, by the way, that the word God never appears anywhere in the Constitution. So that's just a matter of clarification.
No question, just a comment.
Like four times the Declaration of Independence.
Just a moment.
Thank you. One of the strengths of the Constitution is that it's a flexible document. It can be amended. It can evolve over time. And the notion that the Founding Fathers' beliefs about their religious perspectives was part and parcel of the founding document of the country is ludicrous. The Constitution allows for change. It allows for evolution. And the notion that the philosophies, not the theologies, the philosophies of the citizenry ought to be reflected in the laws that the Constitution allows to be produced is the basis of this problem, as I see it, that the under God is very specific. It's very theological. It's not at all philosophical. It doesn't incorporate the broader range. You earlier said in your presentation that atheism was falling under the rubric of a religion. It's not. It's a philosophy. Religion is a philosophy, as I see it, and the Constitution allows for that broad breadth of individuality.
So I'm going to take two more questions, and I'm going to ask the next two questioners, and then after that, Shelley is accommodating some further comment afterward. And I appreciate, perhaps more than when Shelley and I were talking, that this certainly brings out the passions in everyone. And I'm going to ask the next two people to kindly, if they would, have questions. If there are no questions, and if there's a comment, perhaps we can share them with Shelley at the end. So two more questions, if we can.
There's
thanks.
One in the back.
Thank you. I grew up with the One Nation Indivisible, so that feels really good to me. And I'm wondering if that isn't still resonating with the Civil War, as so many things still do, and that in the 50s it got changed to One Nation Under God when it became more of a religious statement. So do you think that the One Nation Indivisible, which is what a political kind of term, reflected the disorder of the Civil War?
Yes, definitely. It was from the Civil War. Francis Bellamy said he had in mind the Civil War when he wrote the words One Nation Indivisible. And people actually said that the pledge helped heal the country because it was something that both the North and the South could get behind. So it's surprising in that they also still needed that healing at that time. And yes, in some ways we still do. Yes.
So I'm curious. I haven't heard the Pledge of Allegiance, thankfully, for a long time. Where is it required and where is it practiced today? Specifically, is it required and practiced in public schools?
Right. It's on a state-by-state basis. And in California, for example, it says all schools should do a patriotic exercise every day and that the pledge would satisfy that patriotic exercise requirement. So it doesn't say that you have to say the pledge. It just said if you did the pledge, that would be enough. And I actually got a call recently this week from the American Legion who are going into, I think it was the Cupertino school district, and say they're not saying the pledge. They're doing their own pledge. So the kids have come up with a pledge to vow to, I don't know what it is they're doing, not to be violent, not to respect their peers, and so on. So they've made up their own pledge. So that is being considered a patriotic exercise. Now, other states have different requirements. So I think, I don't know if it was Illinois, I know definitely some states say the Pledge of Allegiance shall be said in every school district. So that can be a requirement that it's said, even though individuals, teachers, and students don't have to say it.
So can we put our hands together and please thank Shelley again? Two very quick closing comments. When Shelley and I had spoken about coming to do this talk, she assured me that after she shared these amazing and interesting stories that none of us would be able to say the Pledge of Allegiance again for those of us who do and not have new ways of looking at it. So thanks again for sharing those insights. And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned. Thank you.